Hello, welcome to another thrilling episode of Sacred Cheese of Life. This is Emma. This is episode 47 about William Faulkner's short story, A Rose for Emily. This is a very weird little short story. It was Faulkner's first published story. What a way to start. It's odd and it's taught a lot. So if you've taken a literature survey class at any point in your life, you've probably read it. We read it in high school. There are things I love about it and there are things I hate about it, but it's worth studying either way. There, I turned off the air cleaner. That has cleaned up the sound considerably. Who knew? What do you do with A Rose for Emily? A Rose for Emily has so many weird aspects to it that I kind of just want to cover them all in haphazard order because I don't think there's a good logical order to go in, and this is how I always approach the story. First of all, there's a twist ending. There are things that the townspeople don't understand, and it is a first-person plural narrator, which is very unusual. As the intro always will say in any anthology, it'll say how weird that is to have a first-person plural narrator. We think, we see, we knew, we went, we saw, we understood, we allowed. It sets Emily apart as part of not us, right? And that is one of the more upsetting things, I think, about the story, is how the town sets her apart. And that's partly that her father and her family, they were very upper crusty and didn't really belong to the rest of the town, except this is why I wanted to read it, because it's very much like We Have Always Lived in the Castle, where those girls and their family were set apart, right? And they belonged to the upper crusty people and they didn't belong to the villagers. And it's the same in this town, except the upper crusty people also sort of age away from them, and Emily is the only one left. And that's a problem. Okay, I've solved the sound issue that was driving me insane. I was not getting, monitor through my headphones. When that happens, all you can hear is your own voice coming from somewhere else, and it's really distressing and distracting. So anyway, Miss Emily, she's set apart. It's not, I don't know, I guess she does think she's better than everyone else. I'm not sure. It's very similar to We Have Always Lived in the Castle, but it's also a case of, again, the village deciding you're not like us and we're going to watch you and we're going to interfere with your life, like the way the town ladies send for her cousins when they think she's sleeping with Homer Baron, because they're like, well, she's setting a really bad example for everyone else in town and this has to stop. Like, they interfere with her private life in a drastic way. They send for her cousins, and then after a while the cousins are so much more Grierson than Emily that the town is united in getting rid of the cousins, which I find very funny, which they shouldn't have because of what happens to Homer. But anyway, it's the town against her. It's the town against her 100% all the way through. Her father was apparently a really difficult person, and he kept all of her suitors away, and so he's a figure in the story despite not appearing in the story, except in this brief description of, you know, it says we always thought of them as a tableau, and there's the open doorway behind them. There's the father, who's described as a spraddled figure, which is a really ugly word, and I'm going to come back to ugliness. And then Emily standing behind him, slight and dressed in white, right? Like, so she's never her own person until she's all on her own, and she doesn't really know how to be on her own. Emily is a fascinating character because the town is an unreliable narrator. A whole town can think about a person in ways that are not accurate. And she's almost, I mean, she's a lot like those stories of the town that thinks so-and-so is a witch, right? She really is the witch in the story. She sets herself apart, yes, but she's not doing anything to anybody. I don't know why they all are so up in her business and then against her. And it's partly like the mayor a long time ago said that she doesn't owe taxes, then made up the story about how her father lent money to the town and the town would rather pay it back by having her not pay taxes. And it's a fiction, but it meant that this woman was able to go on living in her house, which otherwise she would have lost, right? It meant that she got to continue in her life, which seems like a good thing to me. And it's a very high privilege. It's a huge privilege. But that's also a thing in this story, is there's a class system. And there's these upper class people who the rules are different for them. And this is something I think we're dealing with a lot lately. And it's always very ugly. Nobody wants to talk about class and privilege, especially. Privilege is a very funny thing because what does it mean? What does it mean to be privileged? It means you get something other people don't get? Or does it mean you get what you deserve? Or does it mean you get to get away with things? What does it mean? It's so weird. Like something that is assigned to you might be taken as a privilege from by other people, right? And it's not. It's just your thing. But that's how you are. Like, I don't know. It's very strange. It's something I've been thinking about a lot lately. And it's just something that plays hugely into this story because Emily has all this privilege. She gets to live in this house. She doesn't have money, really. And it says all that's left to her was the house, so there's no money. But, like, she lives there another 40 years, so somebody's paying for the food and the, I don't know what they use to heat. I suppose nothing because they're way in the south, but, you know, like you got to cook with something. So I don't know. Anyway, somebody has to pay for something. You're going to need soap. You're going to need food. You're going to need to pay Tobe, who works there. And I don't know if Tobe gets paid. There's also a real element of racism all throughout the story that is super ugly. And maybe the ugliness is what I should talk about next. So there's Emily, who's privileged and who is absolutely on her own, does not have friends, does not have people, does not have, what am I trying to say, community? She doesn't have community. She doesn't have a cohort. She doesn't have people who are with her. So anytime you have somebody who's set apart like that, who's set on their own, things are going to be weird, especially with this first-person plural narrator, so that it's us against them. I think a lot about how we're supposed to feel about characters in fiction. It's something I struggle with a lot. It's something I really enjoyed about Jellicoe Road, and I really enjoyed it about I Capture the Castle, and I really enjoyed it about We Have Always Lived in the Castle. Whether a character is sympathetic or whether you like them and want them to get what they want, those are big things. How is that accomplished? And in this story, you kind of resent Emily and you kind of don't want her to get what she wants. And that's tricky in a story to have an unsympathetic. She's not the main character. She is. She's the only character, really. She's the main character, but it's not her point of view. And we're seeing her from the outside, which you always do in a third person narration. But we're seeing her from the outside via an unreliable narrator. It is a fascinating little story. It really is, in so many crafty kind of ways, right? Like, what? First person plural narrator studying someone they don't really like. And they're sort of psyched when bad things happen to this person. And this is kind of that's exclusionary when you treat someone that way. And lots of groups are like this. They'll decide who the outsider is and treat that person as the outsider and persecute them, whatever. They even say at one point in this story, you know, when she buys arsenic and they're like, well, we thought then she would kill herself and we said that it was a good thing. Whoa, what? That's not okay. You want her to kill herself? And they sort of see her as a character, like you might see that in fiction. It's how you might treat a fictional character. But she's a real person in their lives and they treat her like a fictional character. They treat her in a very distant kind of way. It's extremely messed up and I don't care for it. When I read this, I think, well, they sure don't like Emily and I feel bad for Emily. That's not, I think, what they would have wanted. These imaginary first-person plural narrator people. I don't think that the intention on their part is for you to feel bad for Emily. But I feel bad for Emily. I feel like they're shutting her out. They're not treating her as one of them. And they would probably say, and I'm just imagining all this here, you know, we wanted to include her. We wanted her to go to church and we wanted her to join in our things. But if they were treating her like a frickin' alien, why would she join their things, right? She wouldn't. She wouldn't want to, and she wouldn't do it. So, are you really wanting her to join? Or do you just want her where you can look at her and watch her and comment about her to yourselves? It's kind of a hateful story. And I'll come back to the ugliness now. Okay. So Emily is described only in ugly ways. And I almost want to read you some of this because it's so yucky. Like, it's really gross. And it's not how you describe somebody you care about. And I don't think they do care about her. Okay, so here she is when we first see her. This is when they've come to see her about the taxes. I was going to tell you the page number. You don't need the page number. They rose when she entered, a small, fat woman in black with a thin gold chain descending to her waist and vanishing into her belt, leaning on an ebony cane with a tarnished gold head. Gold doesn't tarnish. Her skeleton was small and spare. Her skeleton? You don't talk about people's skeletons while they're still in them. Anyway, her skeleton was small and spare. Perhaps that was why what would have been merely plumpness in another was obesity in her. And this gets really gross. Sorry. She looked bloated, like a body long submerged in motionless water, and of that pallid hue. Her eyes, lost in the fatty ridges of her face, looked like two small pieces of coal pressed into a lump of dough as they moved from one face to another while the visitors stated their errand. Yep, that person describing her hates her, okay? When you describe someone in ugly, ugly terms like that, you hate them. If you love somebody, you don't care what they look like. You're just like, oh, they have a sunny smile and they're, you know, you don't describe them as fatty ridges. You know what I mean? Like, that is a hateful description. And I am constantly coming down on writers about this, because if you describe someone or something in hateful terms like that, the reader will also hate them. You're trying to make them hate them. So if you say someone is like munching and slurping their food, you hate them. You want us to hate them. And you have to be really careful with ugly words like that. Like, you can just say, if you like them, you just say they ate. Do you know what I mean? They ate and drank, or they, I don't know, nibbled, or something like that. Like, food words especially get into this, and I'm always after people about this. Like, don't give me hate words if you don't want me to hate the person, because I'm going to hate them if you give me hate words. So she's described, first of all, that's her skeleton. That's a dead person. And then she's described compared to a dead body that's been floating in water, submerged in water. That's disgusting. It's also twice you've called her dead in the past short paragraph. And then her face is described as two lumps of coal stuck into a mass of dough. These are not loving comments, okay? Like, this is somebody you hate. You only describe people in ways that make you hate them if you hate them or you want someone else to hate them. It's not kind. It's not generous. It's not affectionate. Okay? That's not cool. And even when she's skinny later, they still hate her. So where's the skinniest? Here she is. She gets sick. Here it is. I found it. Okay, this is when she's buying the poison. Oh, so she's been dating this guy, Homer Baron. He goes away for a little while because the cousins are there and they chase him out. And then she carried her head high enough, even when we believed that she was fallen. So they think she's been sleeping with Homer. It was as if she demanded more than ever the recognition of her dignity as the last Grierson, as if it had wanted that touch of earthiness to reaffirm her imperviousness. Like when she bought the rat poison, the arsenic. That was over a year after they had begun to say, "Poor Emily," and while the two female cousins were visiting her. "I want some poison," she said to the druggist. She was over 30 then, still a slight woman, though thinner than usual, with cold, haughty black eyes, in a face the flesh of which was strained across the temples and about the eye sockets, as you imagine a lighthouse keeper's face ought to look. "I want some poison," she said. "Yes, Miss Emily, what kind? For rats and such?" I want the best you have. I don't care what kind." And then she says, "I want arsenic." The druggist looked down at her. She looked back at him, erect, her face like a strained flag. "Why, of course," the druggist said, "if that's what you want, but the law requires you to tell me what you are going to use it for." Miss Emily just stared at him, her head tilted back in order to look him eye for eye, until he looked away and went and got the arsenic and wrapped it up. When she opened the package at home, there was written on the box, under the skull and bones, quote, "for rats," end quote. So the next day we all said she will kill herself, and we said it would be the best thing. When she had first begun to be seen with Homer Baron, we had said she will marry him. Then we said she will persuade him yet, because Homer himself had remarked he liked men, and it was known that he drank with the younger men in the Elks Club, that he was not a marrying man. Later we said poor Emily, behind the jalousies as they passed on Sunday afternoon in the glittering buggy, Miss Emily with her head high and Homer Baron with his hat cocked and a cigar in his teeth, reins and whip and a yellow glove. You could write a whole paper just on the color yellow in this. The things that are yellow are disgusting. For some reason, he's yellow. So Homer's yellow because he's not good enough for Emily. And then later on, her pillow is yellow and moldy, and there's some other yellow things. It's always a disgusting color in this story. When we next saw Miss Emily, she had grown fat and her hair was turning gray. During the next few years, it grew grayer and grayer until it attained an even pepper and salt iron gray when it ceased turning. Up to the day of her death at 74, it was still that vigorous iron gray like the hair of an active man. Okay, so those are the three times we see Emily. We see her when she's dealing with the taxes, when she's older already. See, it's not told in order. She's older already and fat and gross and described as a skeleton and a floating dead corpse. Like, just disgusting. Okay, so what do you do with a character who's constantly described as gross? They don't say they hate her. They say they hate her by describing her as disgusting. Got it? Yes, we've got it. This is how this is how you literature. So this is high literary fiction. And as usual, I have a problem with literary fiction because it tends to be in the service of ugliness. Like, I guess you wouldn't want a story like this about someone awesome, who everyone thought was awesome, who they loved and described in loving, kind ways, unless, actually, it would be kind of cool if they described her in loving, kind ways and she was an awful, awful person. That would be fun. So there is that dissonance, and you get that a lot in literary fiction where you're saying one thing would mean another. Excellent. Wonderful. That's a great thing. Do that. Do that lots. Do it often. Do it well. Faulkner is, of course, a master wordsmith, and he writes gorgeously. He has all these things in here that I always want to point out to students, like, her face like a strained flag? What does that even mean? What does that mean? Like a flag that's blown by the wind, tight and taut by the wind? Is that what that means? What is that? What does a face look like that looks like that? Like, he gives you these wonderful images that almost don't quite make sense, so you have to stop and work really hard on it and try to figure it out. He describes Homer's shoes later on, like when the people break in and the ladies go into the upstairs bedroom that's been boarded up and locked up, and they have to break down. The ladies don't do it, but they have to break down the door. They wait until she's decently in the ground first. But they describe his shoes, his clothes are neatly folded over the chair. His suit is folded over the chair, and under the chair are his mute shoes, right? Like, who would think of that? Mute shoes? I love that. And I can just immediately remember lots and lots of classes looking at me like, why? Why do you think that's awesome? Okay, why? Because it evokes something wonderful about shoes, that they're no longer making a noise, they're no longer speaking, but it's not a trait that shoes actually have. Shoes don't talk. They do have tongues, but they don't talk. But he does it in just two words. Like, there's this whole thing combined, wrapped up in these two words, mute shoes. His shoes don't get to make noise anymore because he's dead. Got it? Cool. So good. Mute shoes. I'm not sure. See, I don't write literary fiction. Really? I kind of do, but not really. But I'm not sure I would ever use something like that. Like, something so... Maybe I would. I don't know. Like, with a whole thing wrapped up in it. Ah, it's so good. It's such high art. Like, it's really, really well done. It's so... Like, it's poetic to put all of that in two words. Come on. Amazing. I really admire that. And the face, like a strained flag, I love it because it makes you stop and go, wait, what? What do you mean? Like, I know what you mean, but I don't really know what you mean. Like, a friend and I were talking about Dutch the other day. Well, I guess last night and this morning. How it makes us feel insane. It makes me feel insane because I know German and Old English and Norwegian. And so when I hear Dutch and English, I understand a lot of the time and I don't know why. And it makes me feel completely insane. It feels like I'm in sci-fi when I hear Dutch and I understand it. Now, I don't always understand it, but when I do, I understand it without knowing what the words are. It's almost like being a little kid, like a toddler, like when you're just learning to speak and you know what people are saying without knowing what they're saying. Do you remember that? I remember that. It's maddening. It truly makes me feel like I'm losing my mind. How do I understand what you're saying? Like, it's bad enough with German, French, and Norwegian where I can hear it. And sometimes I just know what they're saying. And I'm like, oh, okay. But I can parse the words. I can break down the sounds and I know what the sounds are and I know what they're saying. I can't do that with Dutch, but I still know what they're saying. And occasionally it's just an immediate cognate with German or English or Norwegian. And like my friend was saying, sometimes there's a whole word that's the same as in Swedish, so he gets the word. And it's like that. Yes, exactly. For me, only with three different languages, where suddenly it's like, I know this because I know German, and I'll hear German and understand it sometimes. Like, I don't have to stop with German and think, that word was this, that word means that. I just understand it. Like, it bypasses that because I learned it young enough. So it's very, very odd to have that happen with a language I don't know. Like, I really don't know any Dutch. The orthography is a real barrier for me. I've tried to study it, but the orthography makes me bananas. I cannot stand the orthography with all the doubled letters. Like, I have orthography problems, and I know English, which has the worst orthography of any language. What a disaster area. Clean it up. Eliminate the apostrophe. Get rid of all that O-U-G-H-T kind of stuff and O-U-S. Like, I just get so mad. I got really mad at the word langur the other day. And clangur, which is spelled the opposite way from langur. Like, just makes me irate. So I need to save my energy for more important things. But I can't help it. I see the word clangur. And it's spelled like in British. In British orthography, it's slightly different from American, and sometimes there's an extra U in there, and I'm like, get out of here! What are you doing? Hate it. Anyway, I'm fine. but he does that similar thing. Faulkner does a similar thing, and this is why I guess I was talking about it a while ago, who knows, years ago now, last year, sometime, about how he would I kept reading, like, I read this story in high school, and I was like, he's amazing, give me all his books. And so I started reading all of his books, and his books are like this times a million. Oh no, The Sound and the Fury will make you lose your mind, because it's a similar thing, like Dutch, like, you know what they're getting at, but it's not really in the words that you need to know what they're getting at, so you feel insane. So that's worth a read. No, I'm not going to read it for this. No, I will not read that book again. That book really messed with my mind. I found it kind of distressing. I suppose it's tied up in the same orthography thing. Like, I want to know what you mean. Yes. And I want to know what you mean even when you can't say it properly. Yes, I grade a lot of papers. But when I know what you mean and you didn't say what you mean, it does make me feel like I've just gone off the rails a little bit. So anyway, so we've talked about ugliness, and just about everything is ugly in this. everything's so ugly. Oh boy. Tobe, the hired man who works for her, he's a cook and a gardener, and he does everything. He never speaks. He is described as getting older, and then after she dies, he lets the ladies in the front door. He walks out the back door and keeps going and is never seen again. Where did Tobe go? And I really want, and there's a lot of these out there. I would love to see this story told from Tobe's point of view. You would have to make a lot of decisions and choices, and you'd have to decide, how much does he know? He knows everything, if you ask me. What's he like? Why is he still working there? What's his story that he's still working for the Griersons? Like, does he owe the family a debt like the town is pretending they do? Why is he doing it? Is he doing it out of loyalty? What's going on with Tobe? Like, he's this silent figure who they never talk to. They never ask. And there's this whole class thing also, like, you can't talk to the people who work in the house about the people in the house. I suppose if you're working in somebody else's house, you could. Like, they always say, like, we never talked to him and he never spoke. Dude, you don't know. He probably went to church and talked to all of his friends there. He probably went out and hung out with his friends. Who, you don't know what Tobe's life was like. There's this whole level at which these people are really unobservant. And they did not figure out. And they give you, Faulkner gives you all the pieces. The story is told out of order, as I said. But the narrators don't understand that Emily killed Homer and left him in that bed to rot upstairs and just closed the door. And she had been going in there, and that's the twist at the very end, is you find, they go in and they find, like, and they're really gross, not photos, but, like, illustrations of this online. Do not look at them because they're disgusting. Because they show Emily hatefully, the way the story shows Emily hatefully. She's just a person, but she did kill a guy, but still. But they show, like, a bare skeleton in a bed. No, he was in a nightshirt. He's described as being in a nightshirt. So there's a skeleton in a nightshirt in a bed, and she poisoned him and killed him. Yes. And then she would go lie in the bed with the dead guy or with the skeleton. I don't know how long, because that's a smell, right? Like, you can't really be that. I don't know, people do, though, but ugh, super gross. I think that's the grossest thing. And when we read this in high school, I remember just, like, screaming when I got to the end. I was like, what? Like, I screamed. Very upsetting. It's a horrible thing to do, yes. Yes, granted, killing him is horrible. It's horrible to lie in a bed with a dead guy and pretend he's your boyfriend or husband after all these years. And they find long gray hair up there. So it's not that long ago that it's been happening. And who knows when she locked the door and that such that they had to break it down. I don't know. But it's, I mean, if she's been up there since her hair went gray, it was long after he died. So, ew, like, seriously, so gross. But also, what was going on in this town? So they smelled the smell. First, and this is what I was saying about the narrator, the collective narrator, not getting it. This is the order. She buys arsenic. Homer disappears. They smell the smell. Everybody complains, and the people in the town office or whatever, sorry, my dog's barking. When is my dog not barking? They're like, you can't expect us to go accuse a lady to her face of smelling bad. So she's a lady, so they can't do it. If she was another kind of person or another person, they could, but they can't. So they don't find out that she has a dead guy in a bed, and she's sleeping in the bed with the dead guy. Because after a while, the smell goes away. But before that, they break in. They break into her basement, her cellar, and they sprinkle lime around, and they sprinkle lime around the outbuildings. Because they say, oh, well, Tobe probably killed a snake or a rat, and that's what smells. So they know it's the smell of death. Like, you really can't mistake decomposition. That's a smell. The idea of having a dead guy in the house and living with that smell is beyond. Like, I can't understand how anyone could even begin to do that sort of thing. And I know he based this on a real story, but, like, even, like, a dead mouse that weighs a half an ounce has a tremendous smell. So, like, what was Tobe doing? What was Tobe doing this whole time? He had to work in this house with that smell? Like, where did he live? Did he live in the house? Everything hinges on Tobe. Somebody needs to rewrite this story from Tobe's point of view. Seriously, like, there's so many, and I always wanted to teach a class with these of the pairs of, you know, like, you read Beowulf, and then I think John Gardner wrote Grendel, which retells the story of Beowulf from Grendel's point of view. There's just a million of these. There's an Odyssey one. Is it Wide Sargasso Sea? There's just a million of them. Maybe that's Jane Eyre. I cannot remember. It was 20 years ago, more, that I last planned this, and I'm not doing it now. So anyway, you can find all these pairings, and they're fascinating, because what happens is somebody reads something, loves it so much, but then goes, wait, what was Tobe doing the whole time? And then tries to tell the story from the point of view of Tobe, or, you know, Bertha in Jane Eyre or whatever. Like, you can come up with a whole different thing looking at it from a different angle. And it's very cool. I like it a lot. I think that's worth doing also, like, clearly, especially with an unreliable narrator like this. There's a lot more going on than they know about. These are the people who did not put it together that she bought arsenic. Then Homer disappeared. Then there was a terrible smell in her house. They couldn't do that math. They are not the sharpest, right? And they just, or else they just aren't allowed to think that about somebody like this. I don't know. But, like, why would you not follow those? Like, those are three dots that are very easy to connect, and they did not connect them. Why? Why not? Because they obviously didn't like her. Why couldn't they think this bad thing about her? They thought she was sleeping with this northerner, this day laborer northerner, and they thought that was bad enough that they got the cousins in for an intervention. So they could think that about her, but they couldn't think that somebody died in the house. Even after, and this was another thing that I guess Faulkner drew from real life, her father died and she wouldn't let anyone into the house to take the body away. She kept denying he was dead. So they had that dot also to connect, and they still didn't connect it. Like, oh no, she denied, and it says she had no trace of grief on her face. Oh no, she was in such denial. I don't know. Okay, so you've got your gorgeous writing, you've got your clueless collective narrator that doesn't like her, but still can't add A, B, and C, and D. Like, there's a lot. Come on. You don't have to be a law enforcement genius to try to put that together. But I suppose seeing someone a certain way gives you blinders so that you cannot see past those certain things. You see this all the time with people who are like, I can never believe that he could do such a thing. Well, he did do such a thing. So the problem is in your belief, not in the facts. So, but you can't see past what you think about somebody to see what's actually there. A lot of the time, we're just not good at that as a species. We build a picture in our minds and then try to take or discard facts to fit that picture rather than taking the facts and building the picture from that. It's just how we are. It's just, whoops, my book. It's just human nature, and it's a well-known thing. We're not empirical data people. I mean, it takes a lot of work for people in the sciences to base their findings on empirical data instead of prejudice, preconceived notions. So, yeah, we're not good at that, and they're not good at it, so I should maybe get off their case. But with how they're fictional, what do you do with this story? What do you do with it? And there's so much more I could say. Emily as a character is fascinating, because what is she actually like? Is she what the townspeople say she is? Or is she different and they just hate her guts because she thinks she's better than them? That's a really good way to make people hate you. Decide that person thinks they're better than you, and suddenly you're like, oh yeah? Well, you're not. Like, what? What are you talking about? You're having a fight all on your own. This person's not even involved in. It's just such a weird thing that people are always caught up in. You think you're better than me? No, nobody said that. She was told she didn't have to pay taxes by the mayor. And she didn't for 40 years or whatever. 30 years, 40 years. And now all of a sudden you say she does? Well, she's like, well, no, I don't. I never have. And she even says, like, go look in your records. I have never paid taxes. And they're like, well, you have to now. She's like, I don't have taxes in Jefferson. She's right. She's never paid taxes in this town. And if she's never paid taxes in the town, she doesn't need to start now. I mean, I'm kind of on her side with that one. You can't just suddenly change the rules on her. And there's a whole thing about how this story is about clinging to an old way of life and how it's about the South and people clinging to, you know, pre-Civil War life and wishing for the good old days that were never the good old days. And there's a lot of really ugly language in it. There's a lot of use of the N-word, which is really uncomfortable and awful, and everyone hates it. But I have to keep telling students, like, they're doing that so you hate them. The same thing was in A Good Man is Hard to Find. Remember the grandmother who uses the N-word, and you're like, oh no. But like, yeah, they're doing that so you hate them. That's how you know to hate people in fiction. It's like in Leverage when a creepy dude will look at a woman's butt as she walks by. You're like, oh, now I hate him. Like, it's so quick and easy, and it really works. But you have to step back and go, yeah, they're doing that, so we hate them. Not like the author somehow thinks this is okay. No, they don't. And I mean, not to be like Doylist or Holmesist or whatever, but which I have to get into another day. But like, you go with that reaction, yes, and you're in it, but you also have to step back and look at it as an artifact. It's a thing where someone's doing something to make you feel something, which is how we have to treat literature a lot of the time. We can't just go with our gut reactions and go, well, I don't want to read this because it's using the N-word. Like, okay, but like, things use it and they're using it on purpose. And I'm not saying like, it's okay. It's not okay. And I warn students before we read it, like, just a heads up, the authors are using the N-word to make you hate people who use the N-word. And it is what they're doing, and they're doing it on purpose. And if you don't want to read it, I can give you something else to read. Because that's very awful for a lot of people. And I get that. I mean, I get it from myself, at least. I understand from outside that it's awful. I don't know what it must feel like. It must feel horrible to be in class and have to read that. Like, ugh. So I do always give an option, but like, it is worth seeing what they're doing. Like, it's the same with the hateful descriptions of her. Like, I hate it when characters who are bad people are fat and that's part of why you hate them. Like, that's super lame and stupid, right? Because, and it's the same when people are like, I hate this politician, they're so fat. I'm like, that's not why they're evil. They're evil separate. I can point you to some pictures of skinny evil people if you want. Like, it's a separate thing. Do you really not get that? It's separate. But it still upsets me when people are like, here's a horrible person. See how gross and fat they are? And I'm like, you're being stupid. Like, X does not equal X in this scenario. And so, but like when these terrible townspeople describe her as gross and fat, it's the same as when they use the N-word, right? And so I'm the same as the students. I'm like, stop it. It's horrible. I hate it. Shut up. Get out of here. And at the same time, I'm like, aha, I see that what they're doing, what they're saying is I hate you. And they're using these descriptors to convey that they hate you, right? It's nothing to do with anybody else, da, 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 but it's just like, we don't like that ugliness, and that flinch reaction to that ugliness is real and valid. Like, that's why they're doing it. That's why they're doing it. So that you go, ugly, hate it. Hate that ugliness that you're throwing at me. I hate your hate. Stop being so hateful. But they're being hateful. And we're supposed to see these characters and go, yeah, these characters are hateful. I mean, not to go intentional fallacy on you, but like, that is why it's there. That is why it's there. When a character is doing hateful things, like describing people in that way or using those words, yeah, that's hateful actions. We're supposed to go, and again, here I go, intentional fallacy, but like, if you react to it and go, ew, yuck, maybe don't go about the person they're aiming it at, but the person who's saying the ugly thing. If someone uses a slur against somebody, the problem is not the person who's getting the slur used about them. The problem is the person using the slur. Got it? Good. All right. So what do you do with the rose for Emily? I don't know. I don't know how I can use it. I can try to write better. It always makes me want to write better because I get to like the stupid mute shoes. I'm like, ah, why can't I do that? Not that I'm trying, but I want to because it's so amazing. I don't know. I read my old writing and I'm like, I wrote better back then. But then those are finished drafts and I'm in, you know, drafty drafts. It's not a finished draft. It's a finished copy. It's a finished book. But I'm in draft world, and draft world is always going to be full of errors and mistakes and things and dumb stuff I have to write out, like original ideas that had to go a long time ago, and there's still remnants lying around. Ugh. And I haven't had the mental space lately to work on my book very much. Like, I've just had a lot of just really stressful, stupid stuff going on, and I don't like it, and it needs to quit it. So hopefully that's over. I think it's over. Pretty sure it's over. Working on my draft, I've been doing a lot more development work, and I'm just thinking about the townspeople in this and in We Have Always Lived in the Castle, and whether I can use that, I wonder. We don't have that anymore. We just don't. We don't have a collective consciousness anymore. I'm not sure we ever really did, but there was a sort of fictional one in certain areas. Like, I don't know, like if you came to me and said, what does your town think of this? I'm like, how the hell would I know? They don't talk to me and I don't talk to them. And there's no central venue. There's no like editor of the newspaper. There's no newspaper. There's no collective consciousness. And I know there's like a town meeting or whatever, but like, isn't that like 5 or 6 people? I don't know that it stands for everybody. I don't know. I just don't think we have that anymore. We're so fragmented. And I think we always were, but we would pretend like the editor of the newspaper spoke for the town or whatever. But like, even then there were factions. There were factions within. I mean, there's different political parties, different movements, etc. So even in this story, there's like, oh, well, these people are Episcopalian. Like, and we had to get the Baptist minister to go in. And he said he would never go back. Like, what happened in that meeting? So anyway, I don't know that we have a collective town attitude that I could use in a similar way, except that I could imagine that the town hated having this group of hippies, this commune in their midst, except the whole point is nobody knew they were there. Like, they were really careful about nobody knowing they were there. For one, they were engaged in illegal activity. For another, they were squatting, right? Like, they didn't want anyone to know that they were around. And there could be outrage after the fact, like finding out that it was going on. That would be something people would never stop talking about. Can you believe these people were living out there like for years and raising kids and manufacturing drugs and doing all this stuff, and we didn't even know. Can you believe? Well, I always suspected. I saw a car pull in there one time. You know, like, I could see that being something people would talk about forever. That's the way a town actually works, in my experience. Not like we all think a thing, but like, there's a thing and we all want to talk about the thing. That, yes, that absolutely. Or there's this one landlord who rents these mobile homes to people and doesn't do any upkeep and exploits them. And like, remember that girl last year who, how did I find out about this? I guess I was on the town Facebook and she was like, I need help. I'm renting this mobile home and the landlord won't do anything about it. And there's rats and they've chewed holes in my walls and they came into the living space and they've eaten all our food and destroyed it and they've chewed up all of the jammies for my little toddlers and like this poor girl. And everybody started helping her and somebody found her a place to move to. And like they told her how to, this seems like a short story on its own. They told her how to fight back against this landlord in case he was going to withhold her deposit or whatever. And I went over there one day and brought her a bunch of tins I had so that she could put her food in tins that the rats couldn't get it. Like, I don't know. I had a lot of tins. I gave her a bunch of tins. And it was just like a thing, a practical thing I could do. Not that I'm a hero. I am not a hero. I was like, ooh, I can get rid of some stuff and help her at the same time. But like that kind of thing, like I think people are probably still talking about that situation. You know what I mean? Like that was a thing a bunch of people were involved in and it's a small town. And so that kind of thing. So like people talking about Emily would be like that, except they hated her guts, I think. But like this, the commune thing, like, I think it would be cool to have her town talk about it after the fact as a thing that it was like a scandal that blew up and all these people went to federal prison and they had to haul away. The bomb squad had to come clear out the meth lab and all this stuff. And like, and those, and nobody knew about the kids until later. And then I'm not sure they ever knew the kids were out there because the kids came into town and that's how they got found. And even then it was like, nobody would know they were out where they had been unless they told them. And the boy disappeared and the girl is our girl, Becca. And I don't know why she would tell anyone that. Like, she doesn't have to. Maybe she did. I don't know. But if she told anyone, it was her therapist and her therapist wouldn't tell anyone that. And it doesn't matter because the place is gone. So I don't think anyone tied her to that unless she told them. And why would she tell them? So anyway, I'm trying to think of a way to use this story in my own work and I'm not really seeing it. But I am fascinated by the way a town or a collective group of people. By the way, we don't even know that the whole town actually thought this. It's just this narrator saying it. And it could be some busybody, you know? And I know it's plural, but it's like, my friends and I all think this. And like, yeah, maybe there's 10 of you. And that's even if your town is the size of mine, which I've forgotten the population again, but small town, right? Like there's no way everybody thinks the thing. There's no way everybody thinks a thing. And all of these people sent their kids to Miss Emily to learn how to paint china. So people clearly dealt with her for years. And this is after Homer's dead upstairs. So like people were, and that's how she made some money, I guess, but like people were dealing with her. See, there's contradictions in it. There's contradictions in the perceptions and in the way the story is told, which is, again, also very human. And nobody ever gets their story straight. Nothing is ever clear or straightforward. Or like if I say what happened and you say what happened, it's going to be different stories. Even if we were standing next to each other watching it happen, doesn't matter. It's going to be different stories. And you can watch it on video and you can both see the exact same thing and still say different things about it. And there's a, what's the story? There's a story we always, it's in my hand, I'm sure. There's a story we always used to read that if you're an older sister, an older sibling or a younger sibling, you read it very differently. Like you interpret it one way if you're an older sibling, you interpret it another way if you're a younger sibling. And I always thought that was fascinating. And if I can remember what story that is, maybe I'll read that, but not yet because... man, I was bringing back some stuff, reading some of my old lit survey stories. Like every time I held a discussion on it, it comes back to me. It's funny. So like your position in the family determines how you read things and your socioeconomic background determines how you read things and all sorts of this stuff can, like if you resent Miss Emily for being from a wealthy upper class family, that's going to color how you read this story. That's going to that's going to bother you. Or if you are from that background, you're going to be like, these people have no right to talk about me and Miss Emily that way, right? Like, I don't know. I assume. I don't know. I am not from that background. But it's just, your everything colors what you read and how you read it. There's no straightforward, simple way to read anything. You have to be a person with a background and an existence, which is by its nature specific, in order to read anything. And that's going to color how you read it. So yeah, absolutely. So what do you do with it? What do you do with a rose for Emily? First of all, there is no rose. There's no rose. And I cannot remember, and I meant to text a friend and say, which one of us was it? Because it was high school and it was a really long time ago now. Which one of us was it who wrote that there was a rose in A Rose for Emily? Was that me? Was that you? Was that another one of our friends? I don't remember. Somebody did. It might have been me, but it might not have. I don't know. Might have been me. Really, you can't say. And again, long time ago. One of us wrote on a quiz because, you know, he would make us take quizzes after we read the story to make sure we read the story. One of us, and I'll just take credit for it and say it was me because I might as well take the blame for it, wrote that there was a rose, that she found a rose on the pillow. She did not. And even when I was trying to put this together, I was like, wait, why did we think that? Why did we think there was a rose? And it's because it's in the title, of course, A Rose for Emily, but there's no rose. And the room where Homer is lying dead for 40 years or whatever is all like, there's a rose lampshade and there's rose this and rose that. Everything's rose colored, but there's no roses. So I'm really not, like, I don't know. I guess if you call a story A Rose for Emily and you give me a room that's all roses, I'm going to think there's a rose. I don't know. It's very easy to color in the missing parts that way with your brain. So I don't know about that. And it may not have been me. I really couldn't tell you. So no rose, no rose for Emily. And maybe that's part of the point of the title, is there is no rose. And when she's buried with, it says, masses of bought flowers. As I mean, I guess you could cut them for your garden, but I guess nobody did. Is that the point of calling them bought flowers? I'm not sure. I suppose ideally they would come from people who care about you and they would sacrifice their flowers for you. I don't know. Does it matter if they're bought? Who cares? But that's what he said, and every word matters. So there's no mention of roses in all of that. I don't know. Roses, what are they all about in fiction? They are everywhere and they always mean so much, and they're just a flower, but they're not just a flower. There's a wonderful book called Tea with the Black Dragon. Do you know that book? R.A. McAvoy wrote it, and it's very weird and stands alone as a thing unto itself. Like, I have never read another book like it, which is not really possible because nothing exists alone, but there is a conversation that the main character and the dragon man, have walking down the street, where she says, it's a rose. It's just a rose. It's just a flower. And he's like knocked sideways that she's a Zen master, and then she gets kidnapped. But like, there's this moment. I think she twirls it, and then he looks and the rose is on the sidewalk and she's gone. So that always sticks with me. But like, everybody knows roses all through fiction, right? This is not a thing I need to discuss. Like, Shakespeare and roses and roses and roses. And anyway, they're everywhere. I don't know why A Rose for Emily. I feel like titles sometimes get more importance than they should have because they're just a title and they have to call it something. But when you call it A Rose for Emily and Emily doesn't get a rose, I have to wonder what's going on there. And probably I never really would have noticed it if I hadn't, or whoever hadn't written that on a quiz. Like, I just think it's weird I can't remember also, but it is a long time ago, and we were a pretty tight bunch. Like, we studied together and everything. And I remember mistakes other people made on quizzes that I didn't even make. Like, my friend, I won't name my friend, who said something about there was a macadam lake, and that meant a parking lot. See, this is where you get in trouble with metaphors, because my friend decided that was a lake in Canada somewhere. Macadam Lake. Does anyone say macadam? I don't even know how to pronounce that word. I've only really seen it written, and I keep wanting to say macadamia, which I have to assume comes from someone named MacAdam. Who knows? All right, what am I doing with writing? I think you could talk about this story for another 10 days and never run out because it just goes on forever. But I've got a limited amount of time and a lot of black fly bites on my arm that went crazy last night. And now they're going crazy again. So that's annoying. And also itchy. I hate black flies. They hate non-Mainers. Did you know that? That you react much worse if you're not from here? Which is ridiculous. But I guess you just develop antibodies or something. Who knows how it works? When you're young, if you get it when you're young. And if you don't get it when you're young, you get much worse reactions when you're older. Doesn't that seem unfair? The state of Maine is trying to bite my arm and tell me I'm not welcome. Ugh, so itchy. All right, what do we do? What do we do with this story? What am I going to do with my writing? I'm hoping to have more mental energy now that a crisis has passed. Stupid. So stupid. And I'll have more energy to focus. But like Friday night, went to bed at midnight. Dog woke me at 4, having to go out. And so I took the dog out at 4, and then I went back to bed, and I was still awake by 6. So I was like, heck with this, I'm getting up. So I got up, and I did all my work. I have to work. I have jobs. I do my weekend jobs. And got done and got into the guest bed and fell asleep for 4 hours. So I got all my sleep, but it was all broken up, and I was messed up all day yesterday. And then got very itchy last night with these stupid bug bites, which again, did not bother me all day Saturday. I got them on Friday. Why are they suddenly, something's triggering it. So I have to take Benadryl again, I guess. Like things are all weird and I just want things to be normal. I want everything to be normal and calm and I want to be able to focus on my dang book. It's very hard for me to focus when there's like chaos and mess and things in my peripheral. You know what I mean? I just can't. Like, it's like there's somebody standing next to me and I can't even type when somebody's looking over my shoulder. So it's hard for me to focus with things in the peripheral. So anyway, I'm going to be working on that later once I get this posted. And what do I want to do? I want to finish. I've written some new scenes. So I made this outline-y thing and I've been poking at it and changing it and figuring out like, okay, every time I look at this one part, I don't like it. It makes me uncomfortable. And then I leave. So I obviously have to change that. So I've been working on the parts that bug me. So it's like a ex post facto outline. What's in there? Where should I move this to? What should happen? When should this happen? I don't like where it is. I have to analyze the text as it stands and figure out what to change. That's all that is. And it's a roadmap so that I know where things are. So making the document itself conform to that outline is worky. I have to do that work. I also have to, this is the part that I've been doing this past couple days, figuring out, this is so dumb, Becca's movies, which I've never really liked. And as I write them, I'm like, it could be this. This would be awesome. And then I look at it later. I'm like, no, it has to be something that is part of the story. It has to do something. It can't just be a placeholder. It has to have a function, like, obviously. But, you know, you write things in drafts that are just in drafts. So that's fine. So I have to go through and make these movies matter. She has to write. And so they're shorts. They're really short. I think a minimum of 2 minutes or something like that. They're shorts. And even a 2-minute movie can take you a month to make easily, but they only have a week. And the point is to make them learn how to do it fast and not screw around and to tell a story, beginning, middle, end, quickly. Because when you learn how to do that small scale, you can do it better large scale. Anyway, that's what this person is doing in this class. And so Becca has to have these shorts that are, you know, what are they, 10 scenes, 12, 20, like short, and you can cut and whatnot, but still, like, you've just got to have tight, short stories. And so I have to write them. And she's better at it than I am. And I want them to mean something within the story, but I don't want it to be like this embarrassing, like, here's an illustration of the blah, blah, blah. Like, I hate that when a story is like that. So it has to be something cool and like coming at it from a weird angle and creative and something that she would think up. Anyway, it's really hard, you guys. So I'm working really hard on that and it's really hard. I have to come up with good stuff or it's going to suck. Alternatively, I could do the Icarus triptych thing and never tell you what the story is. And then it's just the activity of shooting is what matters. I might do that for some of them because, like, I just don't want it to be this big, meaningful, like, capital M meaningful thing. It's annoying. I don't like fiction that does that. And so maybe that is better. I don't know. I keep going back and forth. And that's always when I'm in trouble when I'm writing, when I'm not sure which way to go. Like, should I do it this way? Should I make it meaningful? Should I make it matter? Should it be super cool? Or should it just be like, we're not going to talk about that? I almost like it. I mean, I really liked it in Icarus where we never heard what the movie was about. There was a point where Finn explained it to Harriet in the smokehouse and we didn't get to hear it, which was not just because I was being lazy and avoiding it. I'm not saying that's not part of it, but it was also because it wasn't what was important. It's not what's important. I did talk about some other things he was shooting, but not that one. Nope. Because it was not the point. That's not the point. And maybe that's the way to go with this. It's like, maybe the content of her work isn't what matters. Maybe it's the process. It's the execution. It's about her learning to work with other people and giving up her pathological independence. That is what the story is about. One whole day I was driving home from work. I was like, I told my podcast to shut up because I was like, shut up. I said it out loud. You got to shut up. I say that to my podcast a lot because I like podcasts, but they interfere with my train of thought. And it's very distracting, which is the point of podcasts. But sometimes I'm just like, you got to shut up. And then I turn it off. And I drove home thinking about not just the plot, we know the plot, but like what the story is about. And it really is about her giving up her pathological independence, which is why I gave her the grandma, which is why I gave her the grandma with the great house. And I found the house and I took pictures of the house. And I didn't get a good picture the first time because a cop was watching me. And I was like, but anyway, I didn't get very good pictures that time. I had to do it again another day from across the road, not on the side street. So anyway, gave her a family member, and I've come to terms with her and Owen being basically a family, and I've come to terms with opposition. She can't have opposition with these people who she was being oppositional with. She has to be like, we're all on the same side. And she has this new best friend who I wrote in, who I adore, named Lux. Lux. She was named Luz before, but I just was just like, I want it to be Lux instead. So she's Lux. So they are really tight friends and they are both obsessed with the same show and they both use it the same way. Like they use it for emotional comfort and they just like sit there next to each other watching this show. And it's like the most important thing in her life until it isn't. And it's important to have that. It's important to have that thing there that you're going to give up. And I didn't want her just watching it alone, which she does originally, but I don't know. I wanted it to be like a fun group activity. And I gave her the band she's obsessed with. Lux is in the band, Super Basic Fonts. And I just did a lot of stuff. Like a lot of stuff has evolved and changed and it's so much better, but I've still got to fill in. Like I want Lux to be her best friend and I want them to do stuff that best friends do. And it's not all there yet. It's a draft. It's coming. It's coming along, okay? So like every Friday night, the band will play somewhere. And this was something that happened at my college. Like you'd go to the place where the student bands would play and see the student bands play. And it was super fun. I think I went once. I'm not good at crowded, dark basements, okay? Like, it's just really upsetting. The only time I really went was, I believe it was a St. Patrick's Day, and it was a Pogues cover band or somebody like that. Like, I don't know. They were playing Pogues music, and it was really good, and it was super fun, and it made me wish I had done it a million more times, but it probably wouldn't have been fun all those other times. Anyway, that was great. So, I'm giving her that. It just has to be busy and fun and crowded and again, she has to step outside her pathological independence, grasp that she has a grandma, and all of these pieces came together in this beautiful way this past week. So I guess I did do some good work. Maybe don't be so down on yourself, as I told the pizza lady Friday, who was just like, I'm so bad at this. And I'm like, you stop that. You're awesome and you're doing a great job and you have to be your own best cheering section, I said to her. And she was like, God bless your heart. And I'm like, okay, well, thank you. But just like be your best friend. And she even said like, yeah, if I wouldn't say it to little me, I shouldn't say it to grown up me. And I'm like, yes, exactly. That's it. That's it. Exactly. Don't say anything. You wouldn't scream it at a little kid. I mean, you would if you're a horrible person, but If you're not a horrible person, don't scream it at you either. We all have to learn this over and over again. And I'll always remember it now because of the pizza lady who was struggling with some stuff, but was very cool, and she was doing a good job. So why are you so down on yourself if you're doing a good job? And even if you're not doing a good job, you're trying, aren't you? So you're doing good. You're doing fine. And you can do better. That's true of everybody always. You can always do better. That doesn't make you not a good person if you could do better at something. Sheesh. Anyway, so yes, giving up her pathological independence is hard. And the grandma's going to be great. I have to write her. I wrote reams of notes about the grandma, like developing her character and her whole story and how she's about to lose her independence because, you know, you get older, you can't necessarily do the snowblower and the shut up. But then she discovers she has this grandchild I haven't quite decided, knew about but lost track of or didn't even know about. I'm not sure. I wanted them to have met once when she was a little kid, but I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. I don't know. I have to think it through. The mom character needs a lot more work. Like, the grandma's all fleshed out, but the mom is not, and I don't know. Maybe she can be. I might make her the pizza lady. That could be amazing. Just like a young runaway who gets in over her head, gets involved with this thing, gets herself in trouble, figures out something really bad that's going on behind the scenes that's something our girl didn't even know about until the boy who was there with her tells her this one day, and Owen loses his mind and screams at him and throws him out. I wrote all this stuff. Okay, fine, I am doing a good job. I am like the pizza lady. All this stuff got developed this week, and I shouldn't say it passive. I developed all this stuff this week that I still have to really implement, but it's underway. It's planned. It's figured out. It's like the plans for my screened porch that are on a notebook on the stove. And I have to go buy lumber, and then I'm going to go ow a lot once I build it, because even moving 12-foot beams is going to be like, ow, a world of ow. But so what? I can do it. Oh, maybe I can use those planks I have. Tallulah, what if I use the planks I have? You know those planks? Maybe I should use those. Got them. It's a lot less spending money and a lot less lifting. I might do that. They're really heavy, but they'd make a really good base. All right, maybe I'll do that. All right. Putting a novel together is no joke. If you're doing a good job at it, it's really hard. If you want to make it really good and really complex and have everything, like the way things came together this week was just mind-blowing to me. Like suddenly that thing where Owen's been painting people all along. And I'm like, does he ever paint Shay? Maybe she can be filming, because she's always filming, trying to make these movies. She wants to film Shay. Shay, tell me about life back on the commune, because I don't really remember it, because she has all these memory blocks. And so Shay, who's sitting there, sort of trapped, being painted, can't move, starts telling her stuff. And he's a little bit disingenuous. Remember I said he's the kind of person who would walk in and see a muffin on the table and just eat the muffin? Without thinking, like, that's somebody's frickin' muffin and they put that there because they wanted to eat it later. He wouldn't think that. He would just eat the muffin. So he starts telling her stuff, and here's how I can use a rose for Emily. He doesn't necessarily grasp the implications of what he's saying. So he'll say a thing without thinking, like, oh, this is really going to upset Becca. Or, oh, yeah, Samantha, that was your mom. I might change her name. Because it doesn't fit the pizza lady. I don't know her. She liked my name, though, and I said, you can change yours. She's like, you know what? I might do that. It was just a fun little passing interaction on Friday, and it was really interesting to me. I don't know. The pizza was good, but I think it made both me and the dogs sick, so that's not ideal. Yeah, so there's this crucial scene where it all comes out, and that's where she finds out who her mother was and what happened to her. Shay knows. He was there. He saw it happen. Because he was the child of the boss man, and so he was immune from a lot of the consequences that other people got. And so he was always lurking around, and he saw things happen, and he knows where the bodies are buried, and then they have to go dig them up. I mean, not them, but like the coroner or whatever. It all came together in an amazing way, and I'm very happy with it. I just have to write more of it. Like, it's so funny how I'll write like a skeleton of a scene and I won't write the scene. itself because I'm still planning, but I'm writing the skeleton of it. So it's like some of the dialogue's even there, but not the real scene. So I just have to go through all of that, put it where it belongs, and write it out properly. Fine, I'll go do that now after I play with the dog. All right, you may have noticed that the website disappeared and I'm moving it. I migrated the podcast hosting to rss.com. You can still get it. Well, if you're listening to this, you know where to get it through Apple Podcasts. And I'm going to add it to all the other different venues when I figure out how to do that and when I have time. It's labor intensive and I just like didn't have it this week. And so that's going to happen soon. I'm now at, what's the website? I think it's Emma Burns Writes Books. Let me look. Hold on. I say that like you're pressuring me. Gosh, get off my back. You know, Story on the Brain. If you go to this, I think, let me just look. Story on the Brain. If you go to the side and you click on me, there's me, contributors, Emma Burns. That will take you there because it'll show my blogs. Emma Burns Writes Books is right there. So it is at emmaburnswritesbooks.blogspot.com because I'm sick of, it's a work in progress. I'm sick of paying money for a very difficult to use website that is ugly when you're, even when you're doing it right. So I'm not doing that anymore. I stopped it. I don't know why there's two of everything here. I think I do know why. I'll fix it. It's a work in progress, like everything else. So I'm getting that done. You can always find my books on Amazon. Please do. Please go buy a book. That you don't even know how happy that would make me. That would make me super happy. And if you can rate, review, and subscribe the podcast, that would also really help me out. It is a little different looking now in Apple Podcasts since I switched to RSS. So the images come up sometimes with some of the episodes and some of them it doesn't. I don't know why. Don't ask me why, I don't know. And some of the images didn't transfer over. And again, not sure why, it's just images. It's all a bunch of JPEGs. Just do it, but it didn't do it. So I have to go in and fix those. There's things I need to do. It's just so many hours in the day and so many black fly bites. Itchy. So that's good. We're working on it. And I still own my domain. I'll probably get that up somewhere, but I don't feel like paying for it. It's just like pouring money out and I don't want to. So I don't know if I will. I don't know. Maybe I can even just redirect. Can I put a redirect without a website? Nobody knows. Everybody knows, but not me. So that's a thing. So anyway, buy a book, review the podcast and pet your dog and enjoy the spring. It is really beautiful here. Got my garden in this week. Another source of ow and bug bites. And I mowed the grass and everything's caught up. It's so good when everything's caught up, when like the dishwasher is emptied and the laundry's done and the lawn is mowed. I feel so good. I'd feel even better if I actually vacuumed. I'm getting there. But everything's so neat. And the landlord brought me this stove last week that I didn't want and don't need. And now I got it and it was filthy. And so I had to clean the stove. It was this disgusting oven cleaner stuff, all caustic. You had to wear special gloves. And I had to breathe it and it made me sick and I was sick for days, even with a fan on and all the windows open and the vent on, even with all of that, it still made me super sick. So I was sick for a couple days and I had to clean the what do they call it? The racks. Somebody had grilled on the racks, the person who had this before, and he got it by the side of the road. But they had grilled on the racks. So I had to spray them with the oven cleaner outside the fence where the dog couldn't get at it, and then scrub them off because that didn't work, and it just like so much work. And finally, as of today, and I had to clean the drawer, yesterday, I finally got everything put back, like in the drawer and put away, and it's all neat and it's wonderful. That was making me bonkers, having that necessary chaos that couldn't get solved until everything got clean and dry. So now it's all done. Isn't that great? And I've got my workspace and everything's great. So I hope you're doing well and I hope you're reading good things, and send me an email at sacredcheesepodcast@gmail.com. Tell me what you're reading. Tell me what you're writing. I love getting the questions and I will get to the questions, which I did not today and time has gotten away. That's it. Focus yourself like the pizza lady on the sacred cheese of life. Bye.